Ecclesiastes chapter 1, and we're going to read from 13 to the end of the chapter. This is the first part of the first section of the book. Verses 1 through 11 are an introduction, and then from 1:12 over to the end of 2 is the first section of the book, so to speak. Before we read these verses, let's ask God's help. Lord in heaven, we pray that you take these words written so long ago and grant us, we pray, by your Spirit, to see their truth and their importance for us in our day. This we ask in Christ's name. Amen. I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. And I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. This burdensome task God has given to the sons of man, by which they may be exercised, or perhaps afflicted. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed, all is vanity and grasping for wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be numbered. I communed with my heart, saying, Look, I have attained greatness and have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge. And I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is grasping for the wind. For in much wisdom is much grief, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. This is an extraordinarily un-American book. Americans like books with titles like It's a Wonderful Life. And that's not the title of this book. This book, if we were to put a title on it, might simply be All is Vanity. And you say, is the Bible's message that negative? And the answer is, yes and no. When the Bible describes human life under the sun, apart from God, it is a grim picture. In Romans chapter 1, for example, Paul begins the body of his letter by saying, First off, for the wrath of God is revealed against all mankind, because when they knew God as God, they didn't give him thanks or give him praise. I can't think of a more daunting way to begin a letter than to say the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all the ungodliness of men. Later on in Romans, we looked at this last week, Romans chapter 8, verse 20. Paul says that God has subjected the entire creation to vanity or futility. And it's the same word as the word here behind vanity in Ecclesiastes. Now, most of the Bible and most books of the Bible are devoted to saying, but despite this, look what God has done for our redemption. But this book is for the people who just don't want the message of the original sad state of human affairs. And so Ecclesiastes, although not entirely, is sort of the book that takes those notes from Paul's letter and develops them all the way through the book. I call this theology from below. Life under the sun. God is great and good, but human life is cursed. And this is a book, I think, better than any book in the scriptures, to destroy American optimistic illusions, which so much characterize American society in our day and throughout most of its history. Now, 1:12 to the end of chapter 2 is the first section of the book, and it is the preacher speaking as Solomon. Perhaps this is based on something Solomon wrote. A wise man with all of a king's resources, what did he find? Let's look at verse 12. I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. If you'd studied enough archaeology, you might recognize the form of those words. That was how kings would begin an account of all the great things they did in their reign. And you can find loads of places throughout the Middle East where these are inscribed on pillars up on great big stone faces. It would be, I, so-and-so, was the king. And I was king over here, and then follows, and I did this, and I did this, and I did this. So the writer here, the preacher now, is deliberately using the introduction of how a king describes all the greatnesses of his reign. What did this king aim to do? Well, we have it in verse 13. This king set out with all his heart to seek and search out wisdom. You may remember that when Solomon was first king, young man, he went up to worship the Lord at a high place in Gibeon, which is something the Lord still permitted before the temple was built. And there the Lord appealed to Solomon in a vision and said to him, what do you want? Do you want riches? Do you want long life? Do you want victory over your enemies? And Solomon answered and said, none of those. I want wisdom to govern this people well, that I am now king over. I am a young man. And the scriptures describe Solomon as that sort of king, at least as a young man, searching for wisdom. We have the book of Proverbs, a lot of them from Solomon's hand, not all. We look at them week after week. And I think I've mentioned, after I'd done this for about a year, I began to say, you know, there's good stuff here. There's a lot of wisdom here. The book of Proverbs understands human nature, understands life, understands. That's Solomon. He set himself to get this. He wanted to grasp all of human existence. What is a good life? How can one live a good life? He wanted to understand joy and sorrow, love and hatred, violence and peace. What brings each? And Solomon says, what I was after is what God has set all mankind to do. You know, every person at some level is looking for what will make a good life. How can I achieve it? He may come up with really bad answers, but he's got that question. Most people at some time, lying on their beds at night, begin to ponder about God and about eternity. What comes after I die? Where did all things come from in the first place? This is a task given us by God himself to think about these things. Paul said the same things when he spoke to the Athenians. You can find this in Acts chapter 17. Listen to what he says here to the Athenians. He says, God has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth, and has determined their pre-appointed times and the boundaries of their dwellings, so that they should seek the Lord in the hope that they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. What's the task that God has set to the nations? You know, in a weird sense, this, you can sort of paraphrase this. God set each nation to find the true religion. That's the task God gave each nation. Find the true religion. That's the Indian's task. That's the Japanese task. That's the Chinese task. And all nations have made an effort at it, haven't they? All great civilizations have an attempt to find true religion. And you can read about Chinese Confucian ideas. And you can read about Buddhist ideas and Japanese Shinto ideas. Where do these come from? Well, on the one hand, we say as Christians, there is a great deal of deception and falsehood and lies here. But on the other hand, the scriptures say the impulse to try to find out these things is given by God. And Solomon says, this is a tough task. This is an afflicting task. This is, here our translation says, a task we're exercised with. Every now and then I read something by a modern biologist on evolution, and he sort of touches on this question and asks, What is the survival advantage in thinking about God? Where is the evolutionary advantage in thinking about God? And as they start to approach that question, I can almost see them saying, ooh, I don't want to talk on this one. Because this task really isn't from our genes. And it's not from our evolutionary descent. This task that points us towards eternity and towards God, the scriptures say the task came from God. And it's hard to see how it came from any other source. Now, some people devote their entire lives to this. I don't know how many of you have read some of the dialogues of Plato. They're pretty good. If you read some of Buddhist writings, my opinion is some of them are pretty good. You read it and you say, these people have thought deeply. These people have perceived a great deal. They put together great unified systems. There are physicists trying still to come up with a unified theory of physics. There is Buddhism. And you know, people who just avoid the questions, try not to think about big issues, in my opinion, they become more just like the animals, actually. Nothing more than just to eat and to drink and procreate, and you're at the level of nothing more than the animals, but that's simply not human. I think in our society, one of the things that most clearly shows how deeply embedded this is in the human heart is you've got a whole number of people in this country who were raised either at one remove or two removes of the Christian faith, and they still go to bookstores. And have you been through a bookstore recently? How big is the New Age section? It's amazing. This New Age section. You ever pick up some of those books and look at them? They are full of nonsense. But it's nonsense trying to give people some sort of big picture, some sort of grasp on how to live and what's the good life. We got a Christmas letter from one of my, stepsister-in-law. Divorce and children get really complicated with trying to keep things straight like that. I think it was a stepsister-in-law, right? And she's had a hard life, and she's now a family therapist, and she's always spends every spring going to some conference out in the American Southwest where they talk about animal auras. Different animals have different auras around them. And then she talked about, she thinks she saw one on a cat of hers. You know, the people most likely to be interested in this country in things like astrology and so on are the atheists. The Christians, actually, the more conservative the Christian, the more Bible-reading the Christian, the less they have to do with all this New Age and astrology and so on. But before we just dismiss all that, what's in the human heart that makes people, once they've given up Christian faith, go after all of these other things? It's the restlessness that God put there. Eternity in their hearts that makes them say, well, there's got to be more than just eat, drink, and procreate. The task sneaks back even when we say we're not going to deal with it. And people read the advice columns. What is the conclusion in verse 14? I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed all is vanity and grasping for the wind. He says, I've looked at everything under the sun. Nothing accomplishes its goal. Nothing achieves what it promises when it sets out there. Buddhism won't actually give you peace. When I went off to college, and I mentioned I went to when I was young, Swarthmore College was known as the Kremlin on the Krum. The Krum is the little stream there, and it was known for being so far left politically that it was called the Kremlin on the Krum as sort of a local joke on the college. And off I went there to college. I'm still not quite sure why my mother blessed this, except it had this advantage that every weekend I was in church here, which was very important to me. But she gave me a book to read as I went off there. And I thought, this is an odd book that my mother gave me. It's a book that has been often reprinted. It's not so much apropos today as it was 50 years ago. It was a book entitled The God That Failed. I'm just curious. Anybody else here read The God That Failed besides me? It's a series of essays by men and women who in the 1930s had been gripped by Marxism and thought, here is the solution to mankind's ancient old problems. Here is a giant, great, big system. This is scientific socialism. This is the true picture, right? And it was a large system, and it was complicated, and it attracted a lot of smart people who tried to put it into practice in large parts of the world. We know this. It's failed. But by the time World War II was over, an awful lot of intellectuals who'd been into that were already out, and they said, this is awful stuff. This is a God that fails. And I read all these essays, and one after another. A lot of them were dealing with things I didn't even yet know about, but my mother knew enough about. What Solomon says here, or the preacher, remembering Solomon, is that he's looked at all the things that you can come up with under the sun, and they all come up short. They're all vanity. They all fail. My spiritual life at college was really revolved around two things as a Christian. And this came home to me very sharply about halfway through my freshman year. And the two things were this. I'd been raised as a Christian. How did I know it was so? The second question was, this college used to once be Christian. It's not now. What happened? Those are the two questions. And they informed a great deal of my study and my work and my thought and my prayers. And I remember at some point saying to myself, if I don't find good reasons to think that these things are true, I will have to stop being a Christian. But already by sophomore year, this is not something that left me feeling like I would be liberated. You know, some people raised in the Christian church say, throw it over, I'll be liberated. No, it filled me with an awful, horrible sense, then what? Because I come to Solomon's conclusion. If Christianity isn't true and have the answers, there's nothing else to turn to. Marxism is a god that has failed. Buddhism is built on nothing. Muhammad, why would anybody turn to him? People do, but why? And I could go through everything and say rather quickly, no, absolutely not, absolutely not, absolutely not. That's Solomon's conclusion. I've looked and I've seen all the works under the sun. It's all vanity and grasping for wind, both at the large scale and at the small scale. What are things actually like? What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be numbered. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be numbered. Can you imagine running for political office in this country saying what is crooked cannot be made straight? Don't you know, politicians, they have to say, I can fix things. But of course, they can't. They can fix maybe a little piece of this, a little piece of that, but they can't really fix things. And what of the man elected saying, I'll give hope? I listened to a piece of the Stephen Colbert show the other night. And he was making fun of our president. And the tagline was, so much for hope. The newest issue of the New Yorker magazine has their economics journalist go around and talk to seven or eight of the most prominent economists in the country. And the question is, what have you learned from the last 2 years? And he writes, essentially, the most honest answer I got was from the first guy he spoke to. he says he thought very slowly and said, what have we learned as economists from the last 2 years? Quite possibly nothing. Wouldn't we love to have somebody that we could elect as president who will fix the economy? But when you ask the experts and say, well, what will fix the economy? They may give this idea or that idea, but press them a little far and they'll answer, we don't know. Some of you remember David Merkel. He was a member here with his family for some years. And he was working on his PhD in economics. And I'm just picking on economics right now. I could pick on some other field. He was working on his PhD in economics, and his interest was in development. All right, how can you get poor countries to develop and become rich? And that's been a big interest for the last 50 years among economists. And as he got towards his dissertation, he got everything done, he goes to his advisor, and he says, tell me, do we really know anything? And the advisor said, actually, no. Now, undergraduates never get told this, right? You get the textbook version, which says, here it is, assured knowledge, learn this stuff, repeat it on the test, and you go away and you think people know stuff, right? It's only when you get to graduate school you begin reading 18 criticisms of the textbook, and then you get on towards your PhD, and you talk to somebody and who's really in the field, and he admits, you know, actually, we really don't know what causes one country to develop and another one not. What is crooked cannot be made straight. And it turns out that the people who get really, really, really determined to produce a great and wonderful society, they end up doing immense harm. Think of the Cambodian idealists. We don't think of them as idealists, but that's what they were before they got power. They envisioned the most wonderful society of Cambodia with all of the evil pieces of civilization gotten rid of. A wonderful agrarian world reestablished. Back to Eden. That's what they were trying to accomplish. It turns out you had to kill 1.5 million on the way to get started. What is crooked cannot be made straight. And the proof is, of course, you can't even fix yourself. You can't even fix yourself. Everybody who's really set out on a good policy and program of self-improvement, oh, there's some who actually have such strong willpower, they make some sort of progress. But most people, I swim at the Y whenever I get up the energy and ambition to do so. So sometimes I see George there. Zach goes down to the Y. I want you to know your elders try to stay fit. Right. I've met Mike's brother there, but not Mike. I don't know about that. The people who swim on the afternoons, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, there's a handful of old men who've been there for years. Right? We all know each other. Everybody has the same kind of vanilla name, Mike, Bob, Bill. All right, that's who swims there at the YMCA in Lansdowne. Right, and every January 1, we have the same joke. Do you know what it is? How long will the New Year's resolution people last this year? Because every January 5, the number of swimmers doubles. And within 6 weeks, it's back to the same old men and a couple of not-so-old women, middle-aged women. They're no old women. I don't know why. Middle-aged women. That's who's there. And we're back. And, of course, you know, we look at these people and we say, in fact, we've almost gotten to the point of taking bets. This one, 2 weeks. This one, 6 weeks. Right? We can't even fix ourselves. We all know this. What is crooked cannot be straight. Now, the next part's more daunting. And what is lacking cannot be numbered. The Secretary of Defense before the present one was fond of saying, we don't know what we don't know. That's Rumsfeld. He sort of made fun of it, but that's so true. We don't know what we don't know. I have a small library. Some of you have been in my house, and you see there are books in different places. One of my kids was asked at school, you know, they asked the kids, so how many books are in your house? And my child laughed because there are too many to count. But it's still actually a small library. I haven't read them all. I probably never will. I've seen 18 countries traveling. I've lived in three of them. I don't even know all that there is to know about Philadelphia, let alone Pennsylvania. I've actually seen little. Our schools, you can't count everything that you don't know. Our schools aim right now, here's a current cliche, we want to produce lifetime learners. So what? At the end of your life, you're going to know everything? A lifetime learner is just going to peer into a pit with no bottom. Now, I'm not against still learning things, but as though this accomplishes anything genuine in human life. Occasionally, people get tortured. There must be some secret to existence someplace. If I just study hard enough, I'll find it. Maybe it's in the lost city of Atlantis. Maybe it's in ancient Egyptian wisdom. All right, people get on these sort of, you know, kicks one place or another. Maybe it's in those gospels that the evil early church suppressed. All right, there are possibilities. Maybe it's just in physics. Go further and further in physics, we'll get there. But to set out to gain wisdom and to grasp it all is like trying to look at a drawing by Escher, which if some of you know what those are, they're these drawings where you look at them and it looks like it makes sense, but it doesn't. And the longer you look at it, water is flowing uphill here and uphill here and uphill here and uphill, and they're very clever drawings. And if you try to make sense, they will not leave you very happy. There's some people say the secret is to obey the rules. The secret to us to obey the rules. That way you'll live wisely and live happily. And you know what the Bible says? That's wrong. You can set out to be the most pious and perfect person there is and end up like Job. Before tragedies, as we'll see later in the book, the wise are no wiser than fools, because these things happen to all alike. And Jesus says, their purpose is to turn us to God. That's the reason for tragedies. And that's the reason why our search for wisdom under the sun on its own won't get there. We have to look someplace else than under the sun. Now, verses 16 to 18, he begins with a soliloquy. I communed with my heart, saying. All right, we do this. We think and we ponder. I commune with my heart. Look, I have attained greatness and have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge. This is more of the royal boasting form. I have surpassed my predecessors. And then he turns the boast upside down. And what did I get? Grasping the wind. Here's a wise man. Grasping the wind, that's all I got. I set my heart to know wisdom. Maybe it's not there. We'll see this later in the book. He says, I also set out to check out madness and folly. You know, a lot of people in my generation actually did this. Well-educated, smart people at some point saying, you know, this isn't getting me anywhere. How about drugs? And now we're off into madness and folly. Maybe that'll get me somewhere. And a lot of the early drug use was had this sort of idealistic tinge to it. Maybe this is the path to enlightenment. Solomon says he tried that too. He examined wisdom and madness, the crazy and the stupid in life, and the result all is a grasping for the wind. His conclusion in verse 18, for in much wisdom is much grief, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. There's a German proverb I remember from when I studied German, viel Wissen macht Kopfweh. Here is the translation, much knowledge makes headache. That's close to the end here of chapter 1. Increased knowledge, increased sorrow. Because you realize, you know, when you haven't really studied, you think, well, maybe somebody's got it worked out. But once you've really worked at it, then you know there is no way under the sun. No solution to the problem of what's life all about? No solution to the problem of why do bad things happen? Why do bad things happen to good people? Why do good things happen to bad people? Why do bad things happen to bad people? Why do good things happen to good people? There's no answer under the sun to any of this. No sure path to the good life. And it's a God-given burden to still think about these things. I read a description of the Roman world at the time Christ was born. And this is somebody reading the contemporary writings, what that has survived. And he says, what you pick up overall was, on the one hand, they were glad for the peace that Augustus brought after years of civil war. On the other hand, there's a deep sadness over the whole empire. And I think you see some of the same deep sadness in Japanese Shinto work. And I think you see some of the same deep sadness in Chinese Buddhism. A deep sadness with a hard-gained wisdom. We don't know. We don't know. There is no real answer under the sun. Theology from below gives no final answers. I will tell you the courses in college that were the most help to me spiritually. I was a major in history, and I minored in political science and philosophy. The most useful were the philosophy courses taught by unbelievers, and the way we did things, we read the real guys. We didn't read textbooks. And I took a course in philosophy of, it was called moral philosophy, i.e. ethics. And I can give you a quick summary of the outline of this course. It wasn't quite put this way, but this is what the course is all about. In the Western world, having rejected the Bible as a source for ethics, what can we put in its place? And one philosopher after another comes up with an answer. The emotions. The consensus of society. Language. And the next generation of philosophers came along, and you know what they did? They destroyed the previous generation. And we just went through two centuries. That's the only time I really had to read Immanuel Kant. Now that gives a headache. 2 centuries of philosophical work, and the conclusion was, we don't know where morals come from. That was a great conclusion. I picked up a book that wasn't assigned in the course. It was in the bookstore, entitled Catholic Moral Philosophy. I read that book and I said, we're back to the Bible. It was a Catholic philosopher. Then, of course, was a course in the philosophy of social science. And a wonderful professor, an atheist guy from Temple, was our visiting professor. And we went through, and again, we read all the philosophers trying to say what's really going on in psychology, what's really going on in economics, what's really going on in sociology. And he had a quick summary of what we turned up. If you have a really interesting answer to a question, nobody can prove it. And if you have a really verifiable answer to a question, it wasn't an interesting question in the first place. By the time I finished the course, I was persuaded that's true. From below, you really can't get anywhere with the big questions of life. You can learn and learn, and you can get more and more sophisticated, and you can explore all the possibilities. And when you get done, there's a sadness because you can't get anywhere. I read from at the start of the service about the birth of Jesus Christ. Because one of the things the scriptures, and we're going to look at this afternoon, one of the things that Jesus does is he brings us light from above. This is that light that comes into the world and enlightens every man. Luke chapter 1, he is to be a light to the Gentiles. The self-deceived, I think they all have it figured out. For those determined to deny the questions and look downward like animals, those people don't need a doctor, do they? Jesus said, it's not the well who need a doctor, or those who think they're well. Those who think they have everything fine with under the sun. But the preacher says those people are self-deceived and deluded. And my book is to show and explode all their delusions. There's a character in the New Testament that the preacher is most like. I compare him to John the Baptist. John the Baptist, his purpose was to prepare the way for Jesus Christ. And what this book does is to prepare our hearts to know that there is no place to look other than no longer under the sun, but to something that comes from beyond the sun, something that comes from God himself, we need the revelation of God in Jesus Christ. Or we are stuck with that burdensome task with no answer. Here's what he concluded. What is crooked cannot be made straight. What is lacking cannot be numbered. And work at it, work at it, work at it all your life. Lifelong learner. And if you stay under the sun only with what you can think and figure out without looking at God as he speaks in the scriptures through Jesus Christ, you will only in the end know that you have grasped the wind. And much wisdom is much grief. And he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Thanks be to God for his indescribable gift in Jesus Christ.